And tonight on Coast to Coast, two special guests for you as we talk about deja vu, consciousness, and other dimensions. That'll be next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Now, they were my guests back about a year and a half ago as we talk about their work, of course, the Deja Vu Trilogy, Cry the Beloved Mind, Transcendental Physics, and also Now Reality Begins with Consciousness. Let me introduce two of them for you. Professor Verna Nepi, of course, is an internationally known neuropsychiatrist, behavioral neurologist, and consciousness researcher. He's the director of the Pacific Neuropsychiatric Institute in Seattle, Washington, executive director and distinguished professor, Exceptional Creative Achievement Organization, and professor, Department of Neurology and Psychiatry, St. Louis University. Considered to be one of the world's foremost experts on deja vu and has studied anomalous phenomena for more than 30 years. And here is Vernon on Coast to Coast. Hello there, Doctor. How are you?
Hello, George. Good to be back.
You too. Now, do you go to St. Louis often anymore?
No, very rare now.
St. Louis U, it's a great school. Great school out there. And did you enjoy yourself there?
Well, I enjoy everything I do. Well, I try to anyway.
Great. I'm looking forward to this. And let me introduce your colleague, Dr. Edward Close, studied at the Central Methodist College, University of Missouri, Johns Hopkins University, and a number of other schools, earning degrees in, get this, math, physics, environmental engineering. Focus of Dr. Close's work is the integration of science and consciousness studies. And here he is on Coast to Coast. Edward, how are you?
I'm fine. I'm alive, alert, awake, and enthusiastic.
Super. Now, let's talk a little bit, if I can, Vernon, about deja vu, a phenomenon that all of us have experienced. How, as an expert on deja vu, tell me, first of all, how do you get categorized as an expert on deja vu? How did that happen?
I suppose one's colleagues perceive one that way. I suppose if one develops a definition of the area and everyone quotes it, that helps. And if you do research, and before I did research in this area, there was very, very little, that helps as well. So all of those come together in terms of developing some expertise or some renown in an area.
And what is it exactly? Is it the brain tricking us? Or, you know, are we going through some kind of time warp dimension? What's happening?
Interesting question. And potentially, it may be many different answers. So sometimes, indeed, it's the brain tricking us. Sometimes it is, in fact, a distortion in terms of time. And that distortion in terms of time sometimes involves even the brain tricking us again. One side of the brain minimally registering before the answer, the other, or there may be some kind of psychic awareness, some kind of precognition. And suddenly it happens and one thinks, wow, that's happened before. And then, of course, there are all the different explanations in terms of pathology. You know, brain tricking us might be quite normal. It's just a little bit of a delay, the one side to the other, but there may be a link up with seizures in the temporal lobe, for example. And even sometimes we see people who are psychotic, who experience interpretations of reality that are very different. But by far, far the most common, probably in about 3/4 of our population, maybe more, depending on the study, is just the awareness that something has happened. It's happened before. I'm not quite sure where. And then there's the whole component of how much of this is memory, how much of this is a little bit of anxiety. You can imagine you come into a situation, you've been a little worried about going there, and suddenly you see something which is familiar, maybe a picture, and everything comes together. It's okay, I've been through it before.
See, when this happens to me, Vernon, I don't think, okay, this has happened before, and I leave it like that. When I'm in the setting, all of a sudden it dawns on me, I know what this person is going to say. I've heard them say this before in this same kind of environment, and they do. How does that happen?
Well, it depends.
And is that deja vu?
Yes, the way you've described it. However, if you, let's say, had a dream or an awareness, they are going to say the following, and then they proceed to say it. That one would technically call precognition, foreknowledge.
Right.
But the other way around, they start talking, and you know that you've had that before, and then you throw in one more extra component, which is fascinating, and that is, you know what they're going to say next, and they do say it.
And they do say it, and it's mind-boggling when they do, because you're saying, yeah. How did I know this?
Because this is...
Guys, can I chime in on this?
Yeah, come on in, Edward. You're part of the group here.
Yeah, I'd like to say something. In the work that Vernon and I have been doing over the last 4 years or so, we've found that the common understanding of time is probably incorrect based on some quantum physics experiments and results and so forth. We find, and this is a part of the research we've been doing, that time is actually something quite different than we know. And there are other researchers out there, too, now finding the same thing, that time isn't something that flows in one direction at the same rate all the time. And, of course, Einstein's relativity started us on this path because he showed that time is, in fact, flexible and relative to velocity and to proximity to mass and a number of things that actually speeds or slows the time. But also, again, in quantum physics, there's some, has been for years, some ideas that time may indeed actually flow backward as well as forward in some circumstances. And if the consciousness of an individual is tapping into this broader reality mm-hmm. of time than our sort of linear idea of what time is, then I guess what I'm saying is our research gives a framework that might be able to explain deja vu and a lot of other things in a new way that hasn't been done before.
And how much of this is science, Vernon, or paranormal experiences? Can you distinguish the two?
Well, first of all, let's put it this way. You said science or paranormal experiences, which implies that if people have paranormal experiences, this is not science. Well, I think that science involves measuring, testing, evaluating, and certainly from the point of view of research in the area of parapsychology and consciousness studies, there's a lot of science. But I know what you mean. How much of it is science in terms of research? Mm-hmm. How much of it is spontaneous, is subjective? The person is having this experience, and they cannot validate it. They know they're having it. They know they're perplexed. They know in some kind of way they can predict the next stage. They know that when they come into the situation, suddenly there's this whole awareness, this whole flashback of what related to the past. Now, that might be science in that you can study it, but it is a different kind. It's spontaneous. It's subjective.
My late Aunt Vernon and Edward, Dr. Shafika Karegula, her work was in this entire field. She's no longer with us, of course. Wrote a book called Breakthrough to Creativity. She gave up her psychiatric practice and was convinced that telepathy and areas like that were very, very real. And she was obsessed with trying to get some scientific answers to some of this. And then she died, unfortunately, and wasn't able to complete her work. But there's something to it.
She would love what we've been doing.
Oh, yes, no doubt. No doubt. She'd be jumping and immersing into it and everything else. Now, Let's talk a little bit about the consciousness of all of this as well. Let me start with you, Edward, if I can. When people say consciousness, what do they mean?
Well, I think almost every living human being on this planet may mean something slightly different when they say conscious or consciousness. In our work, we've gone beyond just the simple idea of awareness. All sentient beings have a level of awareness, greater or lesser, partially dependent upon their physical senses and upon their brain function. However, consciousness as a general term, we use in a much broader sense that actually consciousness is the ground of being. And of course, now that's a much different definition of consciousness. And we use the word advisedly because everybody has their definition, and so that gives the word a bit of baggage. But we also didn't want to introduce too many brand new terms that makes it sound like we're speaking a foreign language. So when we say consciousness, or in some of our technical papers, we're talking about a background, if you will, that relates to the dimensions of space, time, and consciousness, and that modern science and science in general has had it backward for some time in believing that consciousness emerges from physical evolution. We feel that the truth is just exactly backward, that there is a primary level of consciousness that is manifesting itself and developing and evolving through the physical world. And if it weren't that way, we wouldn't be here to be talking about it, because the second law of thermodynamics works all the time and would reduce us back to maximum entropy. So nothing would ever have developed in this universe without a conscious background, which we're calling the C substrate.
And you, of course, and Vernon, you've collaborated together on Reality Begins with Consciousness. Do you both share the same views, or were there moments that you were at odds, Vernon?
There are moments that we were at odds. It's actually remarkable because we've come from different backgrounds, and yet it seemed that it was very necessary for us to come together, because we have a lot of commonality in views, but we do differ. So let me give you an example. I will just turn it a little around when we talk about consciousness here and give you a common perspective that it also possibly shows the slight difference in views.
Sure.
You know, there are different kinds of consciousness. Traditionally, it's been the most difficult of all terms to describe. So, for example, the neurologist and those working with the brain, behavioral neurology, neuropsychiatry, my specialty, psychiatry, to a large degree, most will say, well, consciousness is awareness and responsiveness, and they will look at it and measure it in that context. So that's one kind, the neurological consciousness. And while you're alive, everything goes ultimately through that brain. And it is those people who will say, well, consciousness is just an endpoint expression of the brain functioning. Then the psychologist will say, wait a minute, there's more to this. We dream, we have experiences, we behave in strange kinds of ways. Some would say, well, what is a normal person? And we'd say, well, maybe a normal person is somebody you do not know very well. Everyone has their own underlying psychodynamics. So that's another kind of consciousness, because then we talk about the unconscious or sometimes the subconscious or the collective consciousness. So now we've got two we've got to integrate. Then you get the quantum physicist, and the quantum physicist comes along and says, there's one group anyway who talk about quantum consciousness, as if all these subatomic particles, in fact, have some kind of consciousness. And that kind of consciousness implies a meaning in terms of experience, but a meaning at that most fundamental, basic level. And the experiments in physics that tend to suggest that maybe things are just not happening completely by chance. And then we have the meditator, for example, or the person who dreams a lot.
Or the psychic, right?
Or the psychic, indeed, yes. And it's like they go the other way around. They experience a broader reality. I call it a higher consciousness. You can talk about it as a higher consciousness coming from the infinite, a higher consciousness coming from the higher dimensions of reality. And they will certainly not fit in with this idea that the brain is all it is. That's very much the materialistic, reductionistic kind of view. So ultimately, I see this consciousness as a single unit, but a single unit expressed in different kinds of ways. Everyone, if you're alive, might even experience this quantum consciousness, but other things might also. At the next level, we have the psychological dynamics with all sorts of different kinds of conscious and unconscious awarenesses. Then we have the brain and the neurologic perception, the ultimate endpoint. And then we have this higher consciousness, the meditator, those who have subjective experiences of any kind. And you've used the term psychic here. And maybe, just maybe, if there's such a thing as survival after bodily death, those people or entities may also be experiencing a totally different kind of consciousness.
True. And this is what also confuses me, Vernon and Edward, that people talk about that consciousness is necessary because you have to have the brain, the physical matter to function to do this. And then there's that camp that says, no, not at all. You don't need the brain at all. This is something that exists outside of the body. Who's right?
Both. Both.
Yes.
Because
can I chime in?
In between.
Go ahead, Edward.
Certainly, there is data that has accumulated in the whole area of consciousness research, which appears to be separating out some kinds of conscious experiences from the brain, and we might have near-death experiences or out-of-body experiences, or I use the example of survival, and you've used the example of psi, in other words, psychic experiences of one kind or another, and we've already spoken about deja vu, and we've spoken about distortions in time, forwards and backwards. Are these all linked up with the brain? Can you all reduce this down to something biochemical? I don't believe one can. On the other hand, at the end of it all, there are accumulations as well as distortions of information relating to the brain that are very, very important indeed.
We're going to take this break, Vernon and Edward, and I want to elaborate a little bit more with you on that, the fact that you need the brain and you don't need the brain to get this done. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Vernon Nepi with us, Dr. Nepi, and Edward Close as well, Dr. Close as well. And we are talking about consciousness, dimensions, deja vu, and here they both are. Vernon, let's pick up again where we left off, you too, Edward, on my question of do you need the physical brain to tap into consciousness or not? And you both say both.
Yeah. Let me bring it back this way, if you will. George, you started this by asking if Vernon and I always agreed on everything, and Vernon brought consciousness up as an example. But let me say that we actually most of the times when we have a disagreement, it turns out to be a semantic one rather than a substantial one. And with regard to consciousness question, let me make it bring it to a more personal note to help you understand my view of consciousness. At about the age of 14, I discovered relativity, Einstein's relativity, and was convinced from that point on that my life was to be a theoretical physicist. And when I started studying physics as an undergraduate and even in graduate school, I was being taught a very materialistically based, and this is the status of our educational system, but my personal experiences were such that I knew that there was something more than matter and energy interacting in time and space.
Was it your gut telling you that?
No, it was even more than that. It was direct personal experiences.
Okay.
That simply could not be explained in the current paradigm. So as early as 1956, I was working on trying to integrate physical science and what I thought of then as spiritual or extrasensory experiences. And during that time, along about 57, 56, 57, I did some work with a colleague that wound up with Dr. J.B. Ryan at Duke University in the area of parapsychology.
Probably the only school at the time doing any worthwhile research.
Exactly right. Yeah. And so my view is that consciousness is, we are, as individual sentient beings, we are individual aspects of a much greater consciousness. And while there are many different ways we can see how consciousness represents itself, ultimately there is a individualized consciousness and there is a primary consciousness, which was really discovered in quantum physics some years ago with the EPR paradox and the resolution to the Einstein-Bohr debate that said that consciousness is involved in the reality that we experience. And that was my starting point to begin to integrate science and consciousness. And then I take it as a personal mission and have for a number of years to bring science out of the dark ages of materialism, because I believe that is a dead end. It can be, it's like anything in science and engineering. There's an infinite amount of time you can refine things, but we've had no real breakthrough, no real new science since 1935.
That's true. Considering everything else has exploded, that hasn't.
That hasn't. And it's because science has left out. Now, they had some really good reasons for doing it. They wanted to separate, in the beginning, science from pseudoscience, science from alchemy, science from magic, science from witchcraft, and so on and so forth. And that was the reason. But it became so ingrained that to even say the word God or spirit in a scientific setting would cause you to lose your job as a scientist, or at least you would lose your credibility. And so it's taboo. It's been taboo in science for some time.
And your colleagues would scoff at you.
That's exactly right. But when you started to develop theories of everything, like our friend Stephen Hawking, and of course, Albert Einstein started working to try to develop a theory of combining using all the primary forces of nature. When you start doing that, here was my immediate thought, is that you cannot have a theory of everything if everything is not in it from the basic a priori assumptions. And what was left out? Consciousness.
All right. And so, Ed Vernon, let's bring in your work with Edward into these other dimensions where you talk about nine dimensions. How did you get to that number, and what does that mean?
Yeah, this is actually a very interesting story. And you know what, George?
What?
It actually began, in a way, on Coast to Coast when we were last on there in November of 2011.
Really? Tell me what happened.
Well, we were talking broadly about our theoretical model, which Ed has called a theory of everything. We were trying to develop a theory of everything, and of course, this was a problem because there were different definitions, so we didn't like it. I used the word meta-paradigm instead, but that's besides the point. So we were trying to develop this, and we realized that within it, there was a certain key, and the key was that we had to look at dimensions, we had to look at consciousness, we had to look at concepts like order and infinity, and where did these all fit in? And we realized we had to unify all of it. So what happened on Coast to Coast? On Coast to Coast, for the first time publicly, actually Dr. Close, Ed, mentioned that we have nine finite dimensions. And we said those finite dimensions, those nine, we weren't quite sure what they were, but we thought there were three of space. That's obvious, like length, breadth, width. This is very easy. The second one was far more complicated, three dimensions of time. Now, we've already spoken about a past, a present, and a future. And the implication was, well, maybe there are other kinds of dimensions. And then we introduced the idea of three dimensions of consciousness. Now, this is what's so interesting about it. Here we had this link up of space, length, breadth, height, time, seconds, hours, but multidimensional time and dimensions of consciousness. And we proposed that space, time and consciousness were all tethered. They were all unified into one. You couldn't separate out the one from the other. And at that first level, we said there were nine finite dimensions. And then we realized you could go higher to so-called countable infinity, which is not really countable because you can't count it, but there's some kind of one-on-one correspondence. That's called the transfinite. And the commonality of this transfinite and these nine initial dimensions is that they are all discrete.
Could they be
like little pixels?
Could they be part of the multiverse? I mean, are these dimensions other universes?
Yes and no. You know, again, Ed pointed out the difference that we sometimes have, and it's very often one of terminology. And it depends how you look at it. A multiverse with different dimensions of time, almost like a tree of life. I start off in one direction and I make a decision because our model allows for free will. One makes a decision and you turn off the road and you go in another direction and another direction and another direction. And this becomes your life. Now, let's imagine that you made a different decision, different trees, different branches.
That's right.
Now, in certain kinds of ways, you could imagine, well, I'm living this life, but what about that other life I could have lived?
It's like the Robert Frost poem, The Road Not Taken.
Exactly. So in a certain kind of way, that is a certain kind of multiverse. Of course, people have all sorts of variants of it. But the important point that I'm making here is that space-time and consciousness are tethered together. They are together. They cannot be separated. Now, let's just start off with what you asked me historically. There are two bits of history that is very interesting here. The one is, you'll remember in 1908, a German physicist named Hermann Minkowski stood up and lectured at a famous conference of physicists and physicians. I'm not quite sure why those two were combined, but never mind. And he stood up and he said, never again will space be separate and time be separate. Henceforth, space and time are unified together. And from this, we got the fourth dimension, three of space and one dimension of time. And then these two people, Close and Nepi, 100 years later, said, never again will space, time, and consciousness be separated out. So we, instead of saying space-time, talk about space-time consciousness.
And it sounds like if you're able to adapt to this, you can time travel. Is that true?
That is true. That is very true, potentially. Look at it this way. We experience our world as so-called four dimensions. We have length, breadth, height, and we have this moment in time. It's not even a real fourth time dimension. It's just the present. So now, a minute ago, we were talking about something that's the past, and in a minute's time, we'll talk about something that's the future. And the present comes running into the future and the past. And there's all sorts of interesting, we spoke about psychic, parapsychological research there, very interesting stuff, but that's the component. Now, imagine if you had a nine-dimensional reality. And let me just say this. We're not just speculating on this.
This is your theory.
This more than theory. It is a model which we have mathematically been able to demonstrate and which anyone can therefore replicate, because there is a certain strange, very curious particle or component of particle where these elementary particles spin in certain kinds of ways and produce certain kinds of strange angles. And nobody for 50 years could solve one of them, called the Kibibo angle. And this is where the other part of this historical story comes in, because when we came out with our initial model on one of these closed groups, I mentioned it, and an astronomer from an Ivy League school said, when you can show me that your model can solve the Kibibo angle, then I'll believe you. Well, it was a crazy, crazy, crazy challenge. Nobody in 50 years had been able to. And the reason why they had not been able to, it appears, was they were just looking at the three dimensions of space and the one moment in time.
Now, in terms of where we are headed as human beings, how does this affect anybody from their day-to-day existence?
I think it affects them a great deal. But let's, Ed, answer this one, and then I will amplify my thoughts.
All right. Go ahead, Edward.
Yes. I have to get in here and say, again, some of the differences between the way Vernon and I look at things actually stem from our training. Let me give you a really quick, I'll try to be very brief, point of view of a mathematician and physicist. It's not maybe there are extra dimensions. We can demonstrate mathematically and through physics that there have to be these extra dimensions. And I developed a method called dimensional extrapolation, which allows you to actually explore these in a way that fits in with number theory and a whole lot of other things begin to fall into place like a big puzzle. Now, how does this affect the future for mankind? I think it is critical, because if you have people like major mainstream Nobel-winning Prize physicists saying things like, the more we learn about reality, the more meaningless it becomes, and that sort of thing, and many mainstream scientists saying we have no need for any such ideas, concepts like God or the divine. We can explain everything through materialistic science. Then what happens? You have this filtered down to the man on the street, and if there's a world with no meaning, there's no morality. When you replace meaning, and what we've done is show that the dimensions, this relates very specifically to how dimensions are defined, when you relate, and this is where Einstein was going and some of the other people 50 years or so ago, to increase the number of dimensions. Some of the very brightest minds went on to five dimensions. The problem is they never included consciousness. Now, when you do and you show that the whole thing is a unified, as Vernon says, tethered, my way of saying it is that each dimension is embedded within the next higher dimension. Just like a two dimensions, like a line, is embedded within a plane, and a plane is embedded within a volume, you keep going and you find that these orthogonal dimensions are all embedded and they all encompass one another, and everything then begins to have meaning. When you have a science that can explain things like UFOs and time travel and out-of-body experiences and psychic phenomena, mm-hmm. which have been verified, which have been, you know, there's so many experiments out there now, like with Dean Radin and other people who have shown that there's no question that these things are real and they exist. Now, if you have a science that can incorporate that and explain it within a comprehensive framework, then you have a meaningful science which trickles down to the man on the street, and morality becomes comes back again, because everyone knows that we are all related at a deeper level, and that any sort of violence against our fellow man is actually violence against ourselves.
Edward, we're going to take this break. We're going to be back with you and Vernon in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. Their website's all linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. We shall be back in a moment. We'll talk about the science behind near-death experiences next.